Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Allegra Houston, whose memoir is titled Love Child. Allegra Houston is the daughter of the director John Houston, sister of Angelica Houston, Tony Houston, Danny Houston. Also, and this is part of the story, the daughter of John Julius Norwich, historian, which makes you the half-sister, actually, of Angelica and Tony, and not related at all to Danny Houston, but you didn't find that out until you were around 11 years old. This is the story of someone growing up with a lot of famous people, but I noticed through the story that you tamped down on the celebrity. Was that deliberate?
It wasn't really deliberate. I tried to tell the story of my life and the sort of nomadism that I experienced because my mother was killed in a car crash when I was 4. She had planned to raise me as a single mother since she was married to one man, John Houston, whom she had left. And my father was another man who had a wife and children on the other side of the canal from where she lived. And that plan, of course, was thrown into complete, it was banjaxed when she was killed in a car crash. And then I sort of began this kind of odyssey of meeting fathers and living with different relatives in different places and different houses. I told my story as equally as I could. I mean, you know, somebody who happens to be an actor is no more interesting or important as somebody who happens to own a restaurant or happens to stay home and look after their kids. So for me, all the characters in the story are equally important. I wasn't trying to write a celebrity memoir. I wanted to write a book about the experience that I've had of bringing the fragments of this fractured family together, of rising above resentments and histories and, you know, the value of generosity and open-heartedness.
At what point in your life did you realize that not only was your life different, which you obviously knew because your father was absent, you had a nurse who stayed with you, a nanny who stayed with you most of the time, and you were shuttled around. Obviously, that was unusual and you knew that, mm-hmm. but how long did it take you to realize that you were in an unusually privileged situation in terms of the society at large, in terms of financial situation and the celebrity situation?
Well, I think I knew that pretty early.
Really?
Because when I moved to Ireland, well, I first went there just before I was 5. My dad's place in Ireland was a very upstairs, downstairs kind of house. It was an estate. There was the big house, which was where he lived. There was the little house, which was where I lived with my nurse, which had been where Mum lived when she lived there, because even by the time they bought St. Clarence, it was a marriage really only in name. And then there was the groom and his family that lived in their house, and then there were maids who wore pink and white uniforms, and there were various sort of people who did, you know, groundskeeping and painted the bridges and all that kind of thing. So there was a butler, there was a cook. As I say, it was a very upstairs, downstairs, behind the green baize door kind of situation. And being a child, you know, I went back and forth through that door in a way that the grown-ups didn't. But I very much knew which side of it was which.
There's a point where, for the first time, you're actually living in what seems to be a normal family house for a short period of time.
And that was the house of my stepmother. Her name is Cece Celeste Houston. I was 10. She had married Dad a couple of years before that. They were married for 3 years, and I lived with her for 3 years, but they were not the same 3 years. She was a pretty unusual person, too.
She's still alive?
Yeah, she is. I just stayed with her the last couple of days in Santa Ynez. She has a stud farm now. But it was a more normal kind of family life than anything I had known before. And as a result, Nurse was sent back to Ireland. Only a year after I started living with her and Dad in that house, they then had a very acrimonious divorce, and he ran off with the maid, basically, and moved to Mexico. But I stayed living with Cece for another 2 years after that, and eventually it was she who told me that this is not your father. I read in the Palisades View, which was the local newspaper in Pacific Palisades, in a profile of Cece, that Cece lived with her son by a previous marriage, her husband John Houston, and John's adopted daughter Allegra. And that was the first I'd ever heard of it, because basically there was a girl at school who went, yeah, yeah, you're adopted. No, I'm not. But I always knew there was something strange, because you don't get introduced to your father when you're 4. When I was 4, I was led into a hotel room, and a woman told me, this is your father. So I always knew there was something a bit fishy. And then when Cece sat me down and told me this, I hadn't dared ask because I guess I didn't want to hear the answer. But then Cece sat me down and told me, and even though it was upsetting and I was feeling much more that I was losing a father than that I was gaining one, but still at least it did make certain things make sense.
Allegra Houston, obviously there are normal people and then there are people who appear to be larger than life. And there are three people, two major characters in your life and one a minor one, who were totally larger than life, so that we kind of look at them and go, wow. And the most important, of course, was John Houston himself, an extraordinary director, writer. You can't underestimate who John Houston was. I mean, you see, There Will Be Blood and Daniel
yes,
Day-Lewis
exactly.
is doing John Houston.
Yep.
Speaking of that, when you saw the movie, what happened? What was your reaction?
Well, you know what? I actually haven't seen it. I was writing my book. I found it very difficult to watch movies or read any other books or take in any other full-length stories into my head. I had an incredibly short attention span. But the reason I know that he was doing, that Daniel Day-Lewis was doing John Houston, and perhaps he would say that he wasn't, but my friend Kate O'Toole, who has been my friend since I was born, basically, her father is Peter O'Toole, she sent me an email saying, Pedro wants to know what you think of Daniel Day-Lewis's impression of your dad. So that was the first I knew of it.
I get the sense in reading the book that he tried to be friendly, but there's always this feeling of distance.
I think that's true. I think he was only ever really genuinely comfortable with his kind of gang, with the guys, with Billy Pearson and, you know, the sort of practical joke gang, right? He was by nature quite formal, and I was very much in awe of him, always. We had, you know, some moments of real tenderness and real, you know, close intimacy, I guess. But much of the time, I really wanted to please him. I really wanted him to think well of me. He could be quite, I think, possibly unconsciously brutal if he thought I wasn't quite up to scratch.
Did he ever talk to you about what he did? I mean, you worked with him on both Victory and also Under the Volcano. Did he talk to you at all about the process of directing anything?
No, he didn't. I mean, I was a very minor functionary on both those movies. I was a production assistant, just basically kind of running around telling people they were wanted on the set or, you know, helping with the camera reports or whatever. He didn't really talk that much about the process, about how he worked. I mean, I knew how he worked. I knew that he had the whole film mapped out in his head before he ever got anywhere near the set. But it had become, I think, almost so automatic to him by that point that it wasn't something that it would have even occurred to him to talk about except in a very formal interviewing or teaching kind of setting.
Well, when you say he had it in his head, what do you exactly do you mean by that?
He called it cutting with the camera. I think he had developed it quite early on when he had shot The Red Badge of Courage. Lillian Ross wrote about this in her book Picture. He then, very soon afterwards, headed off to the Congo to make The African Queen, and in his absence, the studio totally recut the movie because he'd given them the footage. As he felt, he kind of blamed himself. He took responsibility for this himself instead of saying, oh, no, they mangled my baby. It was like, well, I gave them the opportunity. So after that, he tried to shoot as little film as possible. That was his goal. He never kind of did a master and then did the whole scene, you know, the close-up on this one and the close-up on the other person and then the over-the-shoulders and all that in order to give the editors as much as possible to work with, because he knew that if he wasn't there, somebody would do something other than what he wanted. So he already had it completely in his head, and he only shot each little tiny bit of the scene how he imagined it would be cut in the end.
Well, he also began as a screenwriter, and you've written several screenplays, which we'll go into in a little bit, but
let's not.
Well, you teach screenwriting, too.
I teach a writing workshop, which we call the Writing Salon. So it's really more a kind of creativity thing. Basically, we try and teach people to get out of the way of their own imagination and let themselves be surprised by it. I try not to teach too specifically the craft of any particular kind of writing, because I think that's actually something that's almost easier to learn, and it's hard to get out of your own way. I don't think I could have written Love Child if it hadn't been for the kind of training that I got from doing that, the Writing Salon.
In terms of creating a shape to Love Child, being with John Houston at all, did any of that come from him?
I'm sure a lot of it must have. He was very focused on the structure of a story, and his storytelling was very clean.
Did he actually verbally tell you stories? I mean, was he a raconteur? I mean, he must
have
been.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. He was definitely a raconteur. Most of the episodes of his life had been formed into stories by the time I knew him. Because, you know, he was quite old when I was born. He was, I think, 58 when I was born. So he was an old father. That was another way in which my childhood was unusual. Yeah, his storytelling was very clean, very crisp. Not much extraneous material. He liked to kind of, you know, stick to the story, basically. And I think I did absorb some of that from him.
Have you seen most of his films?
I guess I've seen most of them, yeah.
And what do you think is his best?
I guess Treasure of the Sierra Madre, probably. I mean, that's not a very original thing to say, but I love Wise Blood. I'd put Wise Blood up there. I love The Dead. I love The African Queen mainly because of Katharine Hepburn's line of nature, Mr. Allnut is what we were put in this world to rise above.
Did you ever meet her?
No, I never did.
I guess also Treasure of the Sierra Madre was your father and grandfather.
That's right. He died before any of us were born, so we didn't know him.
There's a strain throughout the book of the money coming and going as well, which brings up another issue, which is that when you're living in that atmosphere, you're rich, you're poor, you're rich, you're poor. It goes up and down and up and down.
Dad was comfortable with it. I think it made him feel like a buccaneer that he was never completely settled and rich. And if he was, he'd start gambling it away. But as a child, especially a child who'd already lost my mother and my home once, the thought of losing my home again because Dad couldn't afford to keep it was deeply disturbing and upsetting. And that's always what it meant to me. Whenever anybody said there wasn't enough money, I instantly thought I was going to lose my home, whether it was there's not enough money to keep Allegra, they're not paying enough child support. I kept hearing that. Or your father's going to have to sell St. Clarence. It was always the thought of losing my home again.
When you worked with him on those two films, particularly Under the Volcano, which is quite a good film, did he do any directing specifically with the actors? I mean, how did he work with actors?
I'm sure he did, but he was very private in the way that he worked with actors. He didn't think it was a spectator sport. He would take actors aside to talk to them. The rest of us didn't really hear it.
Do you think the fact that you were a girl made a difference in how he treated you in terms of his expectations?
I don't think the fact that I was a girl made a difference. But I did feel that he was a lot easier on Danny and me than he had been on Tony and Angelica.
Because they were so much older.
Yeah, they were his first two children. Angelica's 13 years older than me. Tony's 14 years older than me. And I think he was very hard on them in terms of expectations. I mean, he expected them to be brilliant and accomplished and charming and talented right out of the gate as children. He didn't praise effort. He only praised accomplishment. And I think he'd mellowed somewhat by the time Danny and I came along.
The film Walk with Love and Death, I think is the name of it.
That Angelica's in.
With Angelica, yeah. And she got terrible reviews, and the film got terrible reviews. You must have been only like 3 or 4 at the time.
I think I was 2, actually. I think she was 15, which would have made me 2. So I wasn't aware of that going on at all. I know she had a very, very hard time working on it with him, and I think she felt ripped to pieces. And when I lived in Ireland, after Mum died, I lived in Ireland for 3 years, and Angelica never came to visit, never heard from her, which I didn't understand was unusual. But I know now was the aftermath of working with Dad on A Walk with Love and Death, and basically she didn't talk to him for 4 or 5 years after that, or barely did, and certainly didn't come to visit.
Had she pretty much given up acting for a while then?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she had. She was modeling at that point.
You really reconnected with her, and one of the things that Love Child, your book, Allegra Houston, is about is, in a sense, a search for love and almost a search for, I don't want to say a mother figure, but a substitute mother figure, which seems to play a role in there. And she became that for you for a while.
Yes, she did. Thank you, Richard, for spotting that, because not everyone has really seen the different ramifications of that title. It was actually Angelica who came up with the title. She made it her mission to come up with a good title for me because she thought that, well, I knew that the working titles I had were no good, and she entirely agreed. So it was her title, and when she presented it to me, she called me up one evening. I was making a bolognese sauce, so I was sort of stirring with one hand and on the phone with the other. That was actually one of the points that she made, that, yes, Love Child describes exactly who, what I am, but I was also a child who was loved. I never felt unloved. I just felt that I was a problem. But I was definitely not consciously searching for that lost parent, but definitely in need of that lost parent. And, you know, I think, and so was Angel. That's one of the things that I realized when I was writing Love Child, is that I wasn't the only one who lost my mother. And she was trying to recreate a family, too.
Well, Tony doesn't seem to play a role. Was he just absent most of the time?
Yeah. He was living in London that whole time. So he would come and visit in Ireland, and he's a falconer. Most of my memories of him from that time are of him with a bird on his fist. He's still a falconer, and he lives in Taos, New Mexico now, as do I, so I actually see a lot more of him. Angelica and I were sort of reconnected when I was living in Long Island with my grandparents, and she was in New York modeling. The next year, we had both moved to California, and Tony was, you know, on the other side of the Atlantic.
You spent a few years on and off in your teens, living either with Angelica and her boyfriends or living with Cece. During those times, the boyfriends were Jack Nicholson first and later Ryan O'Neill. And again, I was talking about larger-than-life people. You spend a lot of time with Jack Nicholson trying to get a sense of who he is. And again, a great actor, but also a larger-than-life person.
A larger-than-life person, but also very surprisingly difficult to write about. When I was writing Love Child, Jack was the hardest person to get on paper. I really struggled with it. I found myself doing all kinds of writing salon exercises to try and, you know, liven it up, to try and find what those little details were that would make him come to life on the page. So I'd write for 10 minutes about what animal he was like, or I'd write for 10 minutes trying to describe him without describing what he looked like. All these kind of things to try and get a sense of him, because he's, at the same time as being larger than life, he's really personally very elusive.
I think that may come with the territory of being larger than life, of being elusive. I don't know. I mean, true about John Huston and Nicholson, and also the third person, which is Brando, who you spent some time with as well, that maybe by being able to be elusive, they become larger than life.
You may be right. My grandpa was larger than life, too, but he was pretty easy to describe. He stood on his head all day long singing, "Oh, What a Beautiful Morning," wearing nothing, I might add, standing on the roof on his head.
When we get a sense of Nicholson, and we all have had it because he's, you know, an omnipresent figure at Lakers games and at the Oscars, that's pretty much the Nicholson you knew.
Yeah, that is pretty much the Nicholson I knew. And, you know, I went to the Oscars with him and went to the Lakers games with him, too. He was wonderful to me. He was so generous and kind and just completely welcomed me into his family. His daughter Jennifer is, can't remember, a year older or a year younger than me, but anyway, near as damn it, the same age. And we became really good friends. And so every weekend, Jennifer and I, you know, went to stay at his house. Angel was living there too. So it was Jack and Angel and Jen and me, and we made this little family. And he would cannonball into the pool and swim with us. But he was still, you know, he would spend a lot of time up in his room reading. He was a great reader, and heavy books, books that I never thought that real people actually read, like Hegel and Spinoza and Nietzsche and so on.
Well, in terms of his career as an actor, did you see any sense of that whatsoever? Would he go, I'm working on a script? Would he try to be in character?
No, he wouldn't try to be in character. He would retire to his room if he was working on a script. You know, one wouldn't see him for hours. He did a lot of preparation. He did a lot of reading around the parts that he was playing. It was all very private. I mean, he didn't kind of like, you know, try on voices or walks or anything in the house. He was always himself. The character in Cuckoo's Nest, that to me was Jack. That was the Jack I knew, that kind of mad, fun-loving, but always very much in control, knew what he was doing. I mean, it was a very, almost like a kind of not calculated, but controlled craziness, controlled wildness.
Do you think that her time with Nicholson made your sister a better actress? I mean, she's a great actress.
I don't know. That's not for me to say. She would say Peggy Fury made her a better actress. She was her acting teacher. But I can tell you that Jack really likes the book. He called me about, I don't know, 10 days or 2 weeks ago, Lexi, and just went on and on about how much he loved it. So that I was very, very happy about that, because I'm very fond of him, and he was very good to me, and I wanted him to like it.
One thing that's not in the book is when your sister won her Oscar for Pritzi's Honor. You don't mention that. Where were you, and did she call you? Do you remember?
I was living in London at that point. That was 1986 or something. I kind of stop telling my story chronologically when I'm about 15 and I started living on my own. And then I follow the story of my relationship with Dad and my relationship with John Julius through to there, well, my relationship with Dad to its end when he died, and my relationship to John, with John Julius to where it is now, which is one of great closeness and warmth. Well, I mean, she didn't need to call and tell me because I was watching it on TV, right? You know, it wasn't like news.
You were jumping up and down.
Yeah, I was jumping up and down. I was completely thrilled, of course.
There's a casual mention there of going over to Marlon Brando's house and playing chess with him.
Yeah. Yeah. Helena, who was a great friend of Jack's, and I would see her described in magazine articles as his housekeeper or something. She wasn't his housekeeper. She was more like his mother, really, and everyone's mother, and my mother, and the Brando kid's mother. She used to take me up to Marlon's house sometimes, and I was her prodigy. She was very proud of how smart I was, and I'm actually lousy at chess. But I think Marlon must have been worse than I was, because she remembers me beating him. I don't actually remember that I beat him, but Helena does.
Do you have any recollection of what he was like?
I didn't know him that well. Helena would take me up to his house to visit occasionally. He would kind of manifest in Helena's house on Monday nights when we were getting ready to go roller skating. Helena was the person who single-handedly started the roller disco craze of the early 80s. And I was her assistant. I was 14, and I was her secretary, and I typed up all the lists of members' names and decorated the roller rink for Valentine's Day and stuff like that. And Marlon had this little game of trying to make us late, and Helena totally had his number, and she'd kind of shoo him out. He'd sort of materialize. He moved very, very silently. He was like this kind of cat, very large, triangular cat, but he still moved like a cat despite the bulk. He would talk very, very quietly. You almost couldn't hear, and you'd have to lean into him to hear what it was that he was saying, and talk very slowly, too. And Helena totally had his number. She knew that he was just trying to waste the time. She'd shoo him out, and I thought this was very impressive. Shut up, Marlon. We're late. We're going. We're out of here.
Allegra Houston, Ryan O'Neill doesn't come across as a particularly great human being. Have you heard anything from him?
I haven't heard anything from him, no. The thing with Ryan was that for 3 or 4 days, he would be the most delightful, the most wonderful, the most generous, the most charming person you could ever want to meet in your life. And then from one moment to the next, it would turn, and you would be scared of him. You'd be genuinely scared of him. He was really frightening. He never hit me. He never did anything to me, but I was genuinely scared when he flipped.
I keep thinking about people like that. I mean, he was living this rich lifestyle. I mean, now he's semi-forgotten.
Except when he's in the National Enquirer. At the time, he was very, very well known, you know, as well known as Jack and Warren Beatty and, you know, the other people in that kind of crowd. He obviously just didn't have the kind of inner resources. It takes a lot of resources to deal with that kind of celebrity, to deal with everybody telling you you're right and you're wonderful and you're God and everything you do is fantastic. And there are a lot of people who break under that kind of pressure, and then those who have the resources, the intelligence, the whatever family histories of their own that enable them to, you know, keep their head while everyone else is losing theirs, people like Jack, you know, they're the lucky ones, and then there are those who fall by the wayside.
It sounds like you don't regret moving out of that life at all.
No, the second I finished high school, I was on a plane. I moved to London. I got myself out of that world. It wasn't my world. I didn't fit in it. I didn't want to be an actress. I didn't have a celebrity hunger, anything like that. I found it all very kind of discombobulating, and I wanted to live in a normal, quote-unquote, whatever is normal. I wanted to live a more normal life.
At Cece's house, there was no maid, or were there?
Well, Dad had run off with the maid, so that left a bit of a vacancy. The vacancy was filled, actually, on the whole, it was filled for sort of periods of about 6 months or so, mainly by friends of Cece's who, you know, needed a place to live, some work, I guess, you know, or in between moments in their lives, and they would move in and look after us, and me and Colin, her son, who's 2 years younger than I am, drive us to school, make us tuna helper for dinner. It was not a very formal kind of arrangement. It was all like a kind of gang of friends, and we pretty much got away with having tuna helper and Kraft macaroni and cheese for dinner most nights.
Before I move on to a little bit about your career since the book ends, which it ends when you're a teenager, one final question. At the the very end of the book, or just before we move into your reacquaintance with your real father, and we deal with the death of John Houston. When he died, Nancy Reagan offered to send a plane to fly him, and you said no because he despised Ronald Reagan's politics. What role did politics play in any of this? Did you ever hear about politics from your dad?
Yes, Dad did talk politics, and he loathed Reagan. He had loathed him since the time when Reagan was president of the Screen Actors Guild and gave names to McCarthy. Dad had taken a very public and brave stand against McCarthy. He and Bogart formed something they called the Committee for the First Amendment. They went to Washington to protest against the McCarthy hearings. Yeah, Dad despised Reagan as a sort of fellow traveler of McCarthyism. He was definitely a political liberal. He believed in all those good things like equality and liberty and generosity and helping people. He was a very generous-spirited man. You know, even though he could be tough on his children, he was very inclusive and welcoming and included me and welcomed me. Most men would not welcome in the child of the woman that they had separated from, that she had had with another man. That's not a usual thing, and I think it, you know, it speaks everything about him. And he felt that politics and government should be conducted in the same spirit, which was that we're all here to help each other, so let's get on with it and help each other and not stab people in the back, not take advantage of other people, and help those who need help.
Allegra Houston, after you went to London, back to London, you graduated Oxford at the age of 21. What did you do then?
Immediately after I finished Oxford, I got on a plane without even going to sleep. There was a party that night, and I didn't even go to bed, and got on a plane, got to L.A. because Dad had collapsed. He used to have these collapses every, you know, year or so, and this one was more serious than the previous ones, and he came out of hospital on oxygen. He had emphysema, so he was, you know, tethered to the oxygen tubes. Danny and I looked after him. Jack lent him a house that he has near the beach. Danny and I lived there with him for the summer and looked after him.
It must have been astonishing to you that he was able in that condition to make a film like The Dead.
I was astounded. And Pritzi's Honor, too, I think he made after that collapse. And he had had an even worse one right before he started The Dead. We were all in Mexico at Las Caletas, his house down there, for Christmas. And he kind of faded into this sort of blankness. I didn't understand what it was because we'd always used the word collapse, and I'd read Bleak House, and I thought he collapsed like Mr. Smallweed collapsed and had to be sort of shaken up again. So I didn't realize that Dad's collapses were just this sort of kind of fading out of presence, this fading out of consciousness. And he did that on Christmas Day that year. It was Christmas of 1986. And he was due to start filming The Dead on like the 20th of January or something. And he was, you know, rushed back to L.A. He couldn't be airlifted out of Las Caletas because there was no space flat enough to land anything. So we put him in the most upright, most solid chair that we could find that would support him in the little panga, the little open boat that we used to get back and forth to town. And he was rushed back to L.A. And it was extraordinary that he managed to make such a beautiful, beautiful movie after that. He actually made it in Valencia, California, right opposite Magic Mountain on the other side of the freeway. He couldn't fly after that last flight from Mexico. There was no way his doctors were going to allow him to fly to Ireland. Of course, he would have wanted to make it in Ireland. So they rebuilt Dublin in a warehouse opposite Magic Mountain, north of L.A., and they filmed it there. And then the second unit went out and took a couple of exterior shots. But that's perhaps one of the reasons why there's so few exterior shots in that movie, is that Dad wasn't there to make them.
And it almost works for the movie.
It does work for the movie. That's why, yeah. I say perhaps. I don't know. That might have been Dad's intention all along. I don't know.
Afterward, you went back to London, and did you get involved in publishing immediately?
Yeah, I did. A friend of mine was the assistant to a legend of British publishing called Carmen Khalil, and he was being promoted to be editor, and he basically passed his job on to me. I did it for 9 years.
And among the people that you work with were Iris Murdoch and Edna O'Brien. Edna, I could just listen to the sound of her voice and just, like, zone out. It's like listening to hers.
Yeah. Yes, it is. It's like some kind of drug, like ecstasy, very happy-making drug.
What was working with Iris Murdoch like?
Well, it was funny because I wasn't her primary editor. That was a man named Jeremy Lewis at Chatto. And basically, Jeremy had gotten to the point where I don't think he actually read her books. He just accepted them and sent them straight off to the printer because she never edited her novels. I mean, they didn't go through an editing process. She delivered them. That's the way she wanted them. They were set in type, and that was the end of it. So I was given charge of a reissue of a book she had written on Jean-Paul Sartre that was called Sartre Romantic Rationalist. And she had written a new introduction to it, which was like 80 pages. It was a very long introduction. It was kind of almost longer than the book. And I didn't know that she didn't go through an editing process, so I sent her editorial notes. And I was like, 22 or something. So it was terrible. But she very graciously, wrote back and actually accepted some of my suggestions. And when she had packaged up the typescript to send back to me, there was a knife in it. And I never knew if that was intentional or not. But it kind of sharp, like the kind of knife you'd use to pare fruit with or something. So I stuck it in the pin board over my desk because I thought it was kind of cool to have a knife stuck in the wall that had come from Iris Murdoch.
You went on to work for a while. You got back into film through the company Pathé.
Yeah, that's right. It's a distribution company in London, and they were also trying to get into film development. And because of my background in publishing, I knew the agents and the publishers. So my job was to search for properties that, stories that might be developed into movies, and also to go to festivals and look at movies that were trying to get distribution and, advise as to whether or not we wanted them.
When I went on IMDb, I found out that you also co-authored storylines for Heart to Heart. And I'm thinking, wait a second, you would have been really young for that.
I was like, 15 or 16, and I used to go and spend weekends with Cece, my stepmother, after I didn't live with her anymore. She and Angelica had a major argument about where I should live because Cece thought it was Ryan O'Neill's house was a very inappropriate place for a 13-year-old girl, and she was entirely right, but Angelica had seen the possibility, I think, of creating this family. And so she wanted to take me, and Cece had no legal rights over me, and Angel was my sister. So I would go back and spend weekends with Cece, and she was friends with Stephanie Powers and Robert Wagner. And we thought it would be fun to write some storylines for Heart to Heart. And we wrote five, and they bought three, and they filmed one. So if anybody ever watched Heart to Heart, there was a story where the Hearts decided to sponsor an ice skating girl for the Olympics. And I can't remember how the story went, but the villain was the coach, and he tries to run her down with the Zamboni. That was our story.
Oh, you wound up writing a lot of screenplays, which you didn't want to talk about before. They've never been produced.
Yeah, well, there you go. That explains it, right?
Well, what happened? I mean,
well, it's really hard to get a film made, and I don't write thrillers. I don't write action movies. I don't write comic books. I don't write sequels to something that I haven't written the first thing of. Obviously nobody's going to give me that job. So, the kind of stories I want to tell are not the kind of stories that it's really easy to get financed.
You eventually fell in love and had a child, and you moved to New Mexico. You live in Santa Fe then?
I live in Taos.
You live in Taos, which
yes.
is about an hour,
70 miles north of Santa Fe.
And you work on whitewater rafting occasionally.
Well, my husband that I'm not married to owns New Mexico's oldest and now largest whitewater rafting company. He's been doing it for over 30 years, so I help him run it. I don't guide.
And primarily you deal with something called the Writer's Salon, which is a writer's workshop in New Mexico, which you mentioned before. And that's twice, two, three times a year?
Yeah, we do it every year in Taos in the summer for 6 days. It's sort of four full days plus a sort of top and tail. It's a sort of workshop retreat where people can come to this incredibly beautiful place at a lovely time of year. And we basically kind of let the imagination come out and play. We specifically don't work on, whatever projects people bring to us. I'm an editor. I've been an editor for a long time. And I don't believe editing is a spectator sport. Rather like I mentioned earlier, Dad didn't believe that working with actors as a director was a spectator sport. I think it's something that should be done one-on-one. I don't believe in group criticism and those kind of writing workshops. It's just not my thing, not my way. So people may be working on a project, but the exercises we do are very specifically designed to be throwaway exercises. And we do a lot of write for 10 minutes about this or that because, hey, if you only wrote it in 10 minutes, how can it possibly be any good? Once you remove the necessity for something to be good, then you actually find that you get something pretty interesting.
You said at one point, the more improvising we do, the better writers we become.
I think that's absolutely the case. And I've learned that in doing the writing salon. My partner in this enterprise is a performance poet, a slam poet. So he's very much from that sort of improvisational tradition. And I'm very much from the sort of editing, thinking, intentional, getting it right from the start sort of tradition, which never helped me. And getting into this more improvisational, playful mindset, I think, is definitely what enabled me to write Love Child. I can't imagine that I could have written it without those years of imaginative play, basically. I found it helped enormously if I did something every day. It was a sort of, you know, like a kind of yoga practice or something, a daily thing. I usually write in coffee shops because there's enough distraction to distract that part of your brain that wants it. Whereas at home, if there isn't enough distraction, then you get a major one, like you get up and do laundry and then you're sunk, right? So I would usually go for 2 hours about that. I was very intimidated by the prospect of writing a whole book. The nice thing about screenplays is they're only 120 pages long max, and there's a lot of white space on the page, so it's not quite so intimidating. You know, 300 pages of continuous prose, even though I'd been an editor and worked with so many writers, felt like a giant undertaking. So I deliberately didn't start at the beginning. I just sat down and started, you know, I would give myself little assignments. I'll write about my grandpa today, everything I can remember about grandpa, or I'll write about, you know, what animal Jack Nicholson reminds me of, or I'll try and describe the way Marlin moved. I would just find little things like that. And then eventually I had 300 pages of rough material, and then I could edit it, and that was fine. I can do that. That was my comfort zone. The hardest thing is facing the blank page. I highly recommend cheap notebooks. The more you set yourself up to write something good, the harder it is. So if you have like a really nice notebook and a really perfect writing room with the right music and, you know, your special chair and nice sort of candles lit and everything, for me, that just totally freaks me out because I feel like I've got to perform. You know, I get performance anxiety. So if I can just curl up in a corner of a coffee shop with whatever music is playing, as long as it's not jazz, and a cheap notebook, you don't have to live up to a cheap notebook. So that helped me a lot.
Well, Allegra Houston, now that you've written the memoir, are you working on a novel?
Working is maybe putting it a little strongly. I'm thinking about a novel. I've got an idea for a novel. I'm sort of brewing on it, as Iris Murdoch used to say.
And a children's book?
A series of children's books.
Allegra Houston, when you're done with a book like this and you're reading it, what insights do you think in the end you get about yourself or about your own life that maybe could only come after reading the book?
Well, I certainly find it much easier to know why I wrote the book now than I did when I started. I knew that when I started it, the time had come to start it because I had a happy ending. I knew I was not ever going to have written a book like this that didn't have a happy ending. And because we had that moment when we christened my son in the Rio Grande and all the members of my family came, Artemis and Jason, my brother and sister, who are John Julius's son and daughter, and him and John Julius, and also Angelica and Tony and Danny, everyone was there, all my family. Some of them had never met each other before. And so for me, that very much was the happy ending. That was the sort of closing of the circle. That was the moment at which the fragments came together into a whole. And I've never been the kind of person that kept a journal or wrote for myself. And I didn't write this book for myself. I really wrote it to be read because I wanted to hold up this candle to the possibility of bringing fragments together. My dad used to say, rise above it, honey, just rise above it. That's something that I think is a very good precept to live by. That's what I wanted to hold up. I was very fortunate to have been brought up in a family that lived by that precept, that, you know, there's just no need to hold on to resentments and histories. Let's just rise above it and be together.
You've been listening to an interview with Allegra Houston, whose memoir is titled Love Child. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.